was. If I don't enjoy what I am doing, I'd better change it, or change my mind. I loved being governor. I had a great time, and I loved affecting public policy. I did things that I look back on and I think, they were important, they were good. But I have a lot more freedom being out of office. And I feel so lucky. When I left office, I didn't have a dime. I didn't own a house or a car. I had to get busy and make a living. I'd get real nightmares that I'd be living in a trailer in my daughter's driveway. My God, I don't know if it would be worse for her or me. So I felt really lucky to work with Harry McPherson and Burl Bernard's law firm in Washington. And then when Jack Martin, the founder and chairman of Public Strategies, talked to me about opening an office in New York, I jumped at the opportunity. Now I spend approximately half my time in New York City and half my time in Austin. What I do is advise executives, mainly of corporations, on their relationship with the public, including government. I help them address a myriad of situations. Maybe the company has an image it would like to change. Maybe it is concerned about legislation that it would like to assist or defeat. It could be that there is a public official that they would like to have me talk to on their behalf. I've had clients that experienced change in personnel at the top, and the new person in charge would like the company to take on his or her vision rather than that of the previous administration. I advise companies and help them develop strategies to address their needs. I still love politics because it is the most pervasive institution in anyone's life. Other than family or religion, no other activity so affects your life and the life of your children and grandchildren. Look at what will transpire in this country because of the government, and it can have good or devastating consequences. You can either do great things, or you can do things that will take generations to change. I look now at the attitude of the administration and the Congress toward the environment, and for the first time in my life, I'm frightened. I can't think of a time when I've really been frightened by the federal government. I look at the area of women's rights, particularly reproductive choice. I look at what is transpiring in public schools. It's going to take generations to alter what's being done, and that is scary to me. When you are able to see a finite end to your life, you begin to want to do all the things that you never did. One of the things I always said I wanted to do was live in New York for a little while, just for the experience of it. Not that it's better than home, but to be able to go to a play or a ballet or an opera almost every night. After about 10 days, I am a basket case. Gossip columnist Liz Smith, who is a good friend of mine from Fort Worth and has tickets to everything, often goes with me. I can't imagine not working. I don't play golf, and I don't have any hobbies I could fill my days with. There are times when I think I ought to be at home more, but I can't figure out what for. Can you imagine anything worse than having me be your mother or your mother-in-law? I mean, I could fix you. I could give you a lot of my attention. My son Dan said, "Mom, you might want to think about being home more." I said, "Dan, I've been thinking about that, and I think I'll come down to your law office and answer the phone." And he said, "Oh, well, never mind." My daughters laugh when I say I stay out of their business. But I think I do. They have no idea the good advice I could be giving them. One thing I won't do is babysit. No way. I write the check, I bring the presents, but I do not babysit. I think it is very important for grandmothers to know they have a choice. If you don't want to be a babysitter, you don't have to do that. I love my grandkids, and I love for them to come see me, but that's it. Once you start sitting for one of your children, you have to do it for all of them. I now have 7 grandchildren, so I could spend all my time babysitting and probably would, and my kids don't seem to love me any less for it. A part of me wants to come home and do something good. Every year I try to raise a little money for a school that was named after me down in South Texas. When I was governor, I declined the opportunity to have a prison named after me, and I think I'm the only governor in history who doesn't have a prison named after her. But to see your name associated with a public school and feel honestly that you did something to help the place, there's no greater thrill. Another part of me wants to go camp out on Padre Island and resist the bulldozers that are going to drill for gas on that island now that George Bush has given them permission. I still want to do that. I want to resist. Certainly I want to do whatever can be done to resist the attitude of the administration towards women's choice. It prohibits federal employees from having their insurance cover birth control, and yet the same program pays for Viagra. If the administration wanted to take care of all those little children that they insist on being born, it might be a different thing. But 25% of the children in America live in poverty. 1/4 of our children. It's an outrage. On top of that, I can't see the point at which the war in Iraq ends. I can't see when we leave and say we're successful. This business of religious war that is worldwide and ongoing is too frightening for me to comprehend, and that's the world my grandchildren will inherit. I think that if my children or my grandchildren had to fight in Iraq, I would be beside myself. Because where does it stop? I'd like to help aging people, too. People talk about their aches and pains, but no one really tells you what to do about them. The assumption is that it's a part of getting old and you take what comes. As I watched my mother age and I saw her physical infirmities, I began to think about myself and what I need to do now in anticipation of all that. My mother started breaking bones, and I broke a bone, and I realized I needed a bone density check. After you pass menopause, you can lose up to 30% of your bone density. I was diagnosed with osteoporosis in 1996. The most important thing you can do is weight-bearing exercise. So I started on a pretty aggressive regimen of taking care of myself. I work out in a gym twice a week. Here I am in tights and a t-shirt with these big guys full of testosterone. So I started talking about osteoporosis in a lecture series, and I got an incredible response. Women lined up afterward to talk about it, because they were either dealing with osteoporosis themselves or their mothers were dealing with it. One woman called my office and asked me to write a book. She said, "What you don't understand is that people will not get motivated talking about their experience with the subject. They will get motivated talking about your experience with the subject." The book is coming out this year. It is appropriately titled, "I'm Not Slowing Down." Liz Smith and I have talked about doing a radio show, but neither one of us can figure out how to find time to do it. We didn't want to talk to people who called in. We wanted to call out. We both have friends all over the country, and I think it would be fun to call a city hall somewhere and ask the mayor, what's going on? We met with 2 or 3 people about the show, but it ended up sounding like a lot more work than either one of us wanted to get into. Maybe we'll get to do it one of these days. I have resisted doing a TV show, though. I have a choice now about how I want to spend my last years, and I don't want to wake up every morning thinking I have to outsmart somebody on television. Ann Richards, 69, is a senior advisor at Public Strategies, Incorporated. She was the governor of Texas from 1991 to 1995. She lives in Austin and New York City. Texas Monthly. Politics. Ann, an appreciation. By Jan Reed. Issue, November 2006. The first time I saw Ann Richards, she was playing bridge with old friends at the home of Fletcher and Libby Boone in the hills overlooking Austin. With kids whooping in the bedrooms, a half dozen card games uproarious in the living room, and much strong drink poured in the kitchen, I was parked on a sofa. I had been invited to the Sunday night tradition because I was courting Dorothy Brown, one of Ann's old friends, and later, her devoted and trusted aide in state government. It was a hard crowd to overshadow, but that never daunted Ann. She was 47 then, a Travis County commissioner. She was a very attractive woman, for all the premature facial lines and a hairstyle that harked back to a time when permanent was used as a noun. Sexiness was a distinct part of her bearing. When she turned it on, she was all blue eyes and dimples. She cocked an eyebrow at the dubious prospects of the hand she'd been dealt, leaned back in her chair and said, "I've just got to tell you all about club," stretching one syllable into 3. "We have such a good time at club. We just talk and talk. and when we get to the end, we vote on what'll be our next topic of discussion. I think I'm going to propose vaginal itch. The body and rowdy feminist was a well-known side of Anne, but something else underlay her crack about the stuffiness and pretensions of social clubs. In a crowd that was well-juiced and thought nothing of it, she was talking about the newness and rawness of her commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. A few Sundays before, her family and close friends had, with great pain of their own, reduced her to sobs in the ordeal of intervention. She walked into a house in West Lake Hills, and on seeing them all, she responded with the instinctive fright of a mother. "Are the children all right?" Hours later, she was on a plane to a treatment hospital in Minneapolis. She later said she tried to fight off their pleas and their harsh evidence of what she was doing to herself and to them, because she thought that if she quit drinking, she'd lose her gift for being funny. "I was terrified," she wrote of the trip to Minneapolis in her first book, Straight from the Heart. "I was a public person. There was no way I could survive it." Anne's long marriage to David Richards, a labor and civil rights lawyer who was also our friend and still is, came to an end in the same period. When Dorothy and I married in 1982, we invited Anne to our wedding on Fletcher and Libby's lawn. She sent us a nice gift and a poignant note. "She wished us all the best," she wrote, but weddings were something she was having a hard time handling right then. Anne was wounded in spirit. By standards she held dear, as a wife, as a mother, as a responsible person, she had reason to feel like crawling under a rock. But that was not her way of doing business. Those months at the start of the 80s were the very time when she began a leap upward in politics that would make her grin, drawl, and grit celebrated throughout the world. Anne was an omnipresent figure in the lives of her friends. She seemed to have been everywhere, seen and done it all, which made her impatient with those of us who were trying to keep up. She was born in 1933, one of the darkest years of the Depression, in a rural community north of Waco. Her dad called on area drugstores, delivering pharmaceuticals, for a salary of $100 a month. She went to Waco High, where she narrowly lost a state contest in debate and met David at an A&W root beer stand. After they married and graduated from Baylor University, he went to law school and she began teaching social studies at 20 in a boisterous South Austin junior high. They were standouts in the Schultz Garden gang of liberals. At 30, living in Dallas, she was a homemaker and political activist awaiting a luncheon speech by the president when it was announced that he'd been shot in a motorcade downtown. Back in Austin 6 years later, she carried on her political activism with friends who attended her Episcopal church in West Lake Hills. Other friends, the writers Bud Schrake and Gary Cartwright, embarked on the fabled zaniness of Mad Dog Incorporated and a would-be acrobatic act, the Flying Punzers. The third punzer was singer Jerry Jeff Walker. Look at the photos on the album cover of Jerry Jeff's storied Viva Terlingua, recorded in Luckenbach in 1973. Anne sits on a picnic table, taking it all in. Like all successful politicians, she was an opportunist with a run of good luck, seasoned by working for local candidates like Sarah Weddington, who was elected to the legislature after arguing Roe v. Wade before the Supreme Court. Anne ousted an incumbent on the Travis County Commissioner's Court in 1976. She was good at shaking hands and promising to keep folks' roads fixed. There was a prickly edge to her feminism, but her articulation of those views had an old-fashioned quality that resonated in Texas. "I know there are exceptions," she later wrote, "and that there are men who do the laundry and who go to the grocery store and plan the meals. But most of the men I know go to the grocery store with a list of instructions, and that list is put together by the female of the household. Men drive the carpool or pick up the cleaning because they are told to. So, if a woman is not there, the whole management of the house suffers." By the time Dorothy and I married, Anne was sober and single, though she and David called it a separation for 2 more years, and she had defeated an incumbent Democratic state treasurer who had been indicted for misusing his office. At the Treasury, Anne found employees trundling numbers on obsolete calculators and undeposited checks to the state gathering dust on desks. She was no banker or computer programmer, but she hired some, and she set about managing the state's money. Anne also had the antiquated authority to commission and pin old-style badges on Treasury agents and other peace officers. As the state's top tax collector, Comptroller Bob Bullock, Anne's mercurial drinking buddy and shrewd political mentor, decided he wanted such a badge. He pestered her for it, and he never took kindly to anyone turning him down. Well known for his love of firearms, Bullock was rumored to have once stuck a pistol in the ear of an offending driver of a New York taxi in which he and Anne were passengers. "I can't commission him as a peace officer and license him to carry a gun," she said with an exasperated laugh. "He'd be dangerous." Bullock decided soon after Anne that he too had better sober up. For several years, Dorothy had been the assistant director of the Texas Office of the American Civil Liberties Union. She burned out and took a few months off, and in the course of her 1985 job hunt, she wrote Anne a shy and tentative letter of interest, telling her old friend that she didn't really know what the Treasury did or what she could offer. "Dorothy, come over here," Anne commanded on the phone. When Dorothy arrived, she told her, "You can do anything you set your mind to." Her job entailed research of myriad issues and knowing the names and personalities of political associates who expected to be recognized, and she drafted correspondence for Anne in a style reasonably close to her voice. Anne liked to work in her stocking feet. At night, when most of the staff had gone home, Dorothy often heard the sound of her padding down the hall, a letter in her hand. Our daughter, Lila, recalls Dorothy marveling that Anne would be talking about policy while pulling out a needle and thread and stitching up a runner in her pantyhose. It's never been clear how Anne got to make the keynote speech at the 1988 Democratic National Convention. She was as surprised as anyone. When she got the chance, she hit a home run, though the speech tailed off when she made it to the part about the ticket, Michael Dukakis, and Lloyd Benson. The lines about George H.W. Bush's silver foot, Ginger Rogers's dancing backward in high heels, Anne's game of ball with her grandchild Lily were matched by the beauty of her, all silver and blue, and the sheer joy of her timing and delivery. She went on stage a little-known state politician and walked off a television superstar. In the 1990 race for governor, the Attorney General, Jim Maddox, expected to win the Democratic nomination with ease, until Anne's catapulting speech. Her campaign staff came up with the idea of launching the campaign with a tour of the Gulf Coast on a chartered yacht. At each stop, the craft would pick up and drop off experts in public and private sectors of the varied locales, and they would brief Anne. She wanted some friends on board who were not these experts. Her campaign staff, or the press. I had been writing speeches and position papers about coastal issues for Gary Morrow, then land commissioner. Dorothy took a week's vacation from the Treasury, and we flew down to Corpus to catch the boat. The plan at first seemed brilliant. Local TV crews swarmed. On a beautiful day, dolphins sported in the wake as the boat cruised into the bay. Anne kept the briefings concise, on subject, and never seemed to lose concentration or interest. As the craft skated on the narrow intracoastal waterway past barges posted with skulls and crossbones, cargoes of toxic chemicals. We learned about refineries and beach erosion and how a healthy diet of shrimp brightens the pink plumage of roseate spoonbills. The state's top political reporters were on board for the duration, and by the first afternoon their eyes were starting to glaze over. They were cracking jokes with their competitors, editors at their papers were dogging them to file, and there was no story. The second afternoon we noticed them trying to get some privacy. They had shoe phones in those days, and on breaks between briefings, they spread out and leaned over the rails, speaking quietly. "There's something wrong with the boat," one was heard to murmur. It turned out that the owner of the yacht, a dapper gentleman who was clearly entranced by the media and the air of celebrity, and his son, who was actually manning the wheel, did not have licenses and therefore could not legally operate the boat. That night in our cabin, as the boat rocked slightly in a slip at Port Lavaca, Dorothy and I witnessed a campaign staff in total jabbering panic. Phone calls flew back and forth. The Maddox people were all over this, they claimed. What if the captain was arrested? Late that night, a young man announced that we were all jumping ship. The newborn Richards campaign was going to chug up the Houston Ship Channel the next day on a shrimp boat with no air conditioning. While we slept on this prospect, Cooler Heads decided that the owner and his son would leave the boat and the tour would continue with the crew's first mate, who was properly licensed, at the helm. The sun was not yet up when Anne summoned me for my counsel. "I just feel bad about the old man," I offered. "What?" she said. "Well, he's been enjoying this, and it is his boat." The set of her mouth let me know that in politics I was a total amateur. Here I was sentimentalizing over the man, who was being well paid for providing that charter, as if he were a child with hurt feelings. "Jan," she said, "I didn't take him to raise." By the end of that primary, in which Maddox and then the press hounded her to admit past drug use, Anne was so far behind Clayton Williams, the rich West Texas Republican, that the November race seemed hopeless. She called in Mary Beth Rogers, her deputy treasurer, to replace the guys, Glenn Smith and Mark McKinnon, who had been managing her campaign. Then Anne's luck kicked in. Among other blunders, Williams cracked a joke about rape, predicted in cowpoke terms that he was going to rope her like a heifer, and refused to shake her hand. Appalled women in the suburbs couldn't wait to get to the polls. Anne was the beneficiary of one of the most spectacular self-destructions in Texas political history. On a blustery January morning in 1991, she led an energetic, multi-ethnic throng down Congress Avenue to take back government. I remember glancing above the sidewalk at windows in the office buildings. White guys in suits were looking down smiling, charmed by the spectacle, inclined to give her a chance. Anne made reform of insurance and ethics guidelines early priorities of her administration, but she is best remembered for sending shockwaves through the agencies and commissions with her appointments of women, Hispanics, and blacks. She and Mary Beth brought Dorothy with them from Treasury and named her the Assistant Director of the Criminal Justice Division. They wanted someone who would keep a close tab on the millions of federal dollars flowing through their hands. They also liked jacking with the minds of ex-cops and wardens, who would read Dorothy's resume and see the words American Civil Liberties Union. Later, Anne put her in charge of building from scratch the country's most ambitious program of drug and alcohol abuse treatment in the prisons. Texas shot from 50th to 1st in the number of beds in a matter of months, though the program has since been scaled far back. Initially skeptical, to put it mildly, several of those wardens are still Dorothy's good friends. Anne's escort to inauguration was the one-time flying punzer Bud Schrake. They went steady, as she put it, for the rest of her life. We'd see the governor and Bud holding cups of popcorn at Sunday matinees among moviegoers who were astonished it was really her. "How are you?" she'd greet the ones who came up, and they seemed to believe their answers mattered. Less dazzled were conservative legislators and the press, which hardly gave her a free pass. One time, as part of her Smart Jobs Economic Development Initiative, she led the Capitol Press Corps to an East Texas factory where laid-off workers were being retrained as welders. A stifling day was made hotter by the welding torches. At the press event that followed, a TV reporter named Jim Moore, who seldom let up on any politician, cracked, "If welding is a smart job, what's a dumb one?" She let him go on sweating under his boom mic for a moment, and then smiled. "You know, Jim, it don't look to me like it takes a lot of smarts to be a microphone holder." Just the same, on receiving a letter from the young daughter of that constant adversary, Anne carried on a warm and encouraging correspondence with the girl that lasted through her college years. In governing, Anne tried to veil the fact that she was a liberal, and in chasing the center, she sometimes looked awkward, even inept. Though no one questioned the hours she put in or her commitment to the ideal of public service, throughout her 1994 race against George W. Bush, her own internal polls told her that this time she had just 47% of the vote. The national press cast Bush as the underdog, but I had a sinking feeling when Dorothy and I attended her re-election campaign kickoff in Austin. It was her birthday. Jimmy Dale Gilmore performed, and she made a fiery speech. But the event didn't have a pulse. Anne acknowledged that she ran a poor campaign in a year that saw a nationwide GOP sweep. But she believed her loss came down to one principle she refused to compromise. A clamor had arisen to allow citizens to carry concealed handguns. With strong backing from law enforcement, she vetoed the legislature's bill in 1993. But the issue wouldn't go away. The National Rifle Association and the Bush campaign used it deftly. She must have gotten tired of hearing about pistol-packing Texans, and one night on the trail she lost patience. Some would say discipline. In her inimitable fashion. She wouldn't mind so much, she said, if these trained shooters were required to hook their pistols to chains around their necks. That way others could say, "Look out, that one's got a gun." She thought the issue and her stand cost her the election. Dorothy works at the legislature now. In March, Ann called and said, "I've got a young woman here who doesn't know what she wants to do with her life." The ex-governor served with the woman's father on the car wash board and wondered if Dorothy might help her find an internship at the Capitol. Recalling how her own involvement in government began, Dorothy said she would gladly try. The young woman eventually joined the House staff of Dorothy's boss, Elliot Neistat. Dorothy then asked her mentor how she was doing. "Not so good," Anne replied. It was one of the only times her voice sounded small. Anne said that the day before, she had been diagnosed with esophageal cancer. She sounded frightened. Who wouldn't be? At her memorial in Austin in September, Hillary Clinton observed that right after September 11, when so many Americans were inclined to put distance between themselves and New York, Anne chose to join the public strategies consulting firm and live in Manhattan. People would call out her name and come up to shake her hand, just as they did in Texas. That's the image I dwell on now, not the bouquets of yellow roses in the rotunda of our Capitol. I can see her strapping her purse over her shoulder, having no harried young male aides to lug it around, as she did when she was governor, and barging up those sidewalks grinning, proud of her good heart and thrilled by the journey. Texas Monthly, a Q&A with Jan Reed. By John Spong. Issue, October 2012. The author of Let the People In, The Life and Times of Ann Richards, talks about the events and moments that influenced the former governor, how she carefully crafted her iconic image, and the challenges of writing about a dear friend. You were friends with Ann Richards. You worked on her campaign in 1990, and your wife, Dorothy Brown, was a close old friend who went camping with her in the 70s and worked for her when she was state treasurer in the 80s and governor in the 90s. Is the Ann you discovered in your research the same person you went looking for? Was she the same person you were friends with while she was alive? Well, I knew she was a great story that first time I ever saw her, in 1979. She was playing bridge, this sexy 47-year-old woman who had complete command of the room. And it wasn't a crowd of nobodies. I soon learned that she'd recently been crushed, that she had just come back from treatment for alcoholism and the intervention that came before that, and that her marriage to David Richards was effectively over. Though they called it a separation for a while, but that night she was playing what they all called gonzo bridge, with six or seven tables going, booze sloshing everywhere, and she was totally at ease. When I dug into her life for the book, it turned out she'd always been right in the swirl of history. She'd been in the crowd watching for Kennedy's speech in Dallas. Her daughter Cecile had been a first grader in the Dallas school where the kids famously cheered Kennedy's death. She and David had been involved with Kennedy's New Frontier and Johnson's Great Society and moved back and forth from D.C. to Dallas and then finally to Austin, where she ran Sarah Weddington's legislative office while Sarah was winning Roe v. Wade. She worked to pass the Equal Rights Amendment as a member of Jimmy Carter's Advisory Council for Women, and she was on the board of the Armadillo World Headquarters. So there was this moment when I was writing where I thought, God damn, I've gotten through 250 pages and she hasn't done anything yet. Right, nothing except have this incredible life. She was serving as Travis County Commissioner when you met her. Was there a thought that she was going to rise as high as she did? No, no. It was hard to think she was looking at being County Commissioner for the rest of her life, and she had this reputation as a tremendous speaker, but she was also deep into feminist politics, which probably wasn't going to help her statewide. But she looked the part, right? In the book you write that she carefully cultivated the iconic image we all came to know. I first read about that transformation in a Mimi Schwartz story, and I could see it in old photographs from before she became Anne. At one point she had a Mary Tyler Moore hairdo. At another she was dressed like an Earth Mother, with her hair long and tied in the back. Then, all of a sudden, her clothing style changed completely. David talked about that, about how suddenly there were hair curlers everywhere. So it was pretty calculated, the image of the smart-mouthed, good-looking grandma who wouldn't make the good old boys too nervous. Sounds like a good subject for a book. The project started when she died. To my astonishment, former Texas Monthly editor Evan Smith called and asked me to write a piece for the magazine after that. Anne, November 2006. I thought, shit, I've never been one of their political writers. Fortunately, he gave me such a tight deadline, 5 days or something crazy like that, that I couldn't get lost in research, couldn't get tangled up in the story. And when it came out, people that liked her really liked it. Then I got a call from somebody at the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library. She was editing a book about governors in American history, and she was looking for rich little pieces by real historians. And me. So I was going to do a piece for her, mostly about Anne, but also about some female governors of both parties who came after. I think I was the first person in Texas to know about Sarah Palin. When I started that, I found Anne had left her papers to what's now the Briscoe Center for American History at UT. And shit! Just the index was 700 pages, single-spaced. I thought, well, I know her family to some extent, a lot of people who worked for her, and now I see this stuff. This might just be possible. And 3 years later, you've got a book. The great coup was discovering all that correspondence in her archive. It was official business, but also these funny Christmas cards she'd sent and love letters with Bud Schrake. And unlike the Bushes and the Clintons and even Obama, I think, she had said that a year and a half after she died, everything was to be opened, save a few personnel matters and most of the death penalty cases. I'd go in and order 5 boxes of files at a time. The hard part was finding a title. Nothing we tried was working. We were going to call it Anne, but weren't crazy about that because Holland Taylor's one-woman play was going to be called Anne, and it was coming out before the book. But the managing editor figured it out, and it should have been obvious. Let the people in. Hell, it's on her gravestone. You spend a lot of time showing Anne either witnessing or participating in things like the Armadillo and the ERA, and explaining the significance of all that cultural history. It created the sense of time and place that made me feel like I was going back to Austin in the 70s. It was like picking up a novel. I'd written a short rock and roll book on the making of Derek and the Dominoes' album, Layla and Other Love Songs, and the editor of that had told me to quit trying to write it like a magazine piece. He had me get away from the old rule of magazine structure, which is, 1, tell them what you're gonna tell them, 2, tell them, 3, tell them what you told them. He said, don't give away your secrets, write it like it's a novel. So I decided to do that with this, to not try anything tricky structurally, to stick fairly close to the chronology, to treat it like a novel with one commanding figure at the center of it, but make it about her times as well. And then just before I started writing the book about Anne, while I was doing all that research, I'd finished a real novel, Comanche Sundown, that got some nice notices, so I was already keyed into that approach. Was it hard to write about a friend? Did you catch yourself feeling like you had to protect her? I went out of my way not to, because if I had written a puff, fluff book about her, I'd get the shit beat out of me by historians and critics. She was a bad drunk, a mean drunk, evidently, and I wrote to that effect. But somehow she kept those skeletons in the closet. How'd she manage that? Was it simply that all the witnesses stayed loyal to her? I think it was that. If she ever did cocaine, she didn't do much. She did end up with a real affection for marijuana, mixed in with her voluminous vodka martinis. One reliable source attributes her first taste of marijuana to Texas Monthly writer Gary Cartwright. I'm shocked. That could have been disqualifying. And when the drug thing came up in the 90 primary campaign against former Governor Mark White and Attorney General Jim Maddox, the press turned on her. They'd asked hardly anything about it, and then all of a sudden they were this howling mob. She was pretty shattered by that. She told her son Dan that she didn't think she'd make it out of the primary. She felt like everything was unraveling. That was hard for her. Everywhere she went, you'd see this sea of young women, and she was really afraid of letting them down, of being their champion and then not being up to the task. Once she got through the primary, she got much more relaxed, even if she figured the race against Clayton Williams was unwinnable. A rancher oilman and a female liberal. What did she have to lose? That's when she became the candidate people saw give that speech at the 1988 Democratic National Convention. And looking back now, the truly weird thing seems to be not that Texas elected a woman, but that we elected a liberal. She was unapologetic about it. That was right when people started to be afraid of the word, and she veered toward the center in the natural course of things. But she was a liberal and didn't care who called her that. And that's the way she governed. She faced down those insurance commissioners. She did progressive stuff on toxic waste and the environment. That was one thing she and former Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock were in sync on, pulling all those agencies into one, giving them some real power they hadn't had before. And she did good work on the border, getting clean water and sewers to the colonias. Did she have an Achilles heel? She should have cut former Texas Railroad Commissioner Lena Guerrero loose, whose career imploded when she was found to have invented key parts of her resume. But shoot, she was loyal to Enron CEO Ken Lay. She came to his defense when the company imploded, and he got sent off to the big rodeo. But I think her problem against Bush was that, politically, she'd met her match. It turned out that those people on the other side were good, and their candidate wasn't bad either. And now they're both viewed as once-in-a-generation type politicians. People were talking about her going to national level, and the person who beat her did. I thought it was real interesting, in sizing up Bush, that he talked to a guy during that time period about wanting the baseball commissioner's job. He said, "These people have me running against Ann Richards, and I don't think I can beat her." I don't know who these people were. I'm sure Karl Rove was one of them. But when it started out, Bush didn't think he could win. But he ran a good campaign, and he won their debate. Clayton was rude to her, and Bush was not. When she was critical or abrasive in the debate with Bush, he would just sit there and look hurt. There was a telling reflection from Mary Beth Rogers about when Ann slipped and called Bush a jerk during the 94 campaign. Mary Beth said that Ann had just done what Clayton Williams had done. She was so offended that this guy had the nerve to challenge her. She knew the minute Ann said it that it would be the turning point. Karl Rove said the same at the time. Bill Clinton's midterm election went so bad for Dems, but she wrote that Ann never blamed him, that she always put her loss on her own shoulders. The conventional wisdom was that she got rolled under by the national election. Hillary Clinton's health care had been a disaster. Newt Gingrich and the Republicans took over the House for the first time in decades. New York Governor Mario Cuomo lost. So Ann just got caught up in a tsunami of national politics. But I think she blew that election. She should have won her base. If she'd been as good a campaigner as she was against Clayton Williams, then Bush wouldn't have been effective. He'd have had to come back and win it the next time. Still, what if she'd won? By the time she started playing at a high level, the years were already ticking off. She'd have been 65 when that second term ended. How much more is any politician going to do at that age, except Reagan? She dug being a national player, but I don't think she saw herself going any further, and she wasn't going to break her neck to make it happen. But here's something that holds true even now. She changed the landscape completely. From the start, she was going to turn things upside down from the old white boys' club. And boy, she did. Some people think some of her appointments were terrible, and some think they were great. But they were women, they were blacks, and they were Hispanics. And yeah, those kinds of people had been employed at those agencies before, but never running them, not doing policy things. Her term was like a parabola. You'd think she would have limped into office considering how bruised she'd been by the primary. Her approval rating was a little better than Clayton Williams's, but it wasn't good. She turned that around on a dime. In 6 months, Burka was blowing kisses at her in Texas Monthly. And so she went on to shake things up on a bunch of levels. Texas Monthly. Remembering Ann. By Paul Burka. Date, September 15, 2006. When Ann Richards was born on September 1, 1933, the governor of Texas was a woman, Miriam Ma Ferguson. She was the wife of former Governor James Pa Ferguson, who had been impeached in 1917. Ineligible to run for office himself, Pa had come up with the idea that Ma should run in his stead. And she did, four times, winning twice. She was just a figurehead while he made the decisions. The Fergusons were notorious for shenanigans like selling pardons to state penitentiary inmates, and a story made the rounds that a stranger, having bumped into Ma while she was walking to the Capitol, said, "Pardon me," to which Ma is said to have replied, "You'll have to see my husband about that." Wouldn't it have been nice to know that a baby girl in Waco would grow up to be a governor who told jokes instead of being the butt of them, and who made Texans, and especially women, proud instead of embarrassed? She was the type of politician Texas had never seen before, a good old gal, sharp of tongue and quick of wit. Anne was a star, so familiar that almost everybody referred to her by her first name. She had the ability, possessed by few male politicians and even fewer women, to expand her personality to fill a room. And fill it she did. That helmet of white hair, that hearty laugh, that thick Texas accent larded onto every tale she told, left no doubt of her presence. She liked to address men by their last name, and there was always an ambiguity about whether she was putting them down or just letting them know she could be one of the boys. My first encounter with Anne was not a happy one. It came in 1987. Democratic prospects for the future still looked bright, but then Bill Hobby, the longtime lieutenant governor, and Henry Cisneros, the mayor of San Antonio, each announced that he would not run for statewide office in 1990. The Democrats were left with a bunch of flawed second stringers whose resumes included demerits ranging from scandal to alcoholism. I wrote a piece for Texas Monthly that predicted the death of the Democratic Party. Not one letter writer complained about any of the other Democrats I had denigrated. But I received a bundle of mail protesting the inclusion of Anne, who was a recovering alcoholic. I realized that I had made a mistake, that the public viewed Anne as different from the others. And I went to her office to apologize, where I got the lecture of my life. Her message was that people can turn their lives around and I should give the benefit of the doubt to those who had tried. It was uplifting, if you weren't on the receiving end. When 1990 came, Anne was one of three major candidates who entered the Democratic primary for governor. The others were former Governor Mark White, who had served from 1983 to 1987, and Attorney General Jim Maddox. The candidates met in a debate at KERA, the Dallas public television station. I was one of the questioners. Maddox had accused Richards of drug use, and one of my co-panelists asked the question, "Have you ever used illegal drugs?" I cannot recall whether Richards was the first or last to answer, but I do remember that Maddox and White each responded, "I have never used illegal drugs, period." Richards, though, looked straight at the camera and said something like, "I want to address my answer to all of you out there who have had problems in your life." She went on to say that she wanted to assure them that they could seek help for their problems without fearing that their mistakes would be brought up to them again and again. I have never been in a place where silence was such a presence, except for her voice. A small audience was in the studio, and not even a cough broke the stillness. I thought we were watching Anne self-destruct on statewide television and that she had lost the race by dodging the question. But I was wrong, again. This was as real a moment as you will ever see on television, and the people watching knew it. She reached through that tube and grabbed them. Richards beat Maddox in the runoff and went up against oilman Clayton Williams, the Republican nominee, in the general election. Anne couldn't win the race, but, as it turned out, Clady could lose it. He had wrapped up the Republican primary early with great television spots. The one everyone remembers was about getting tough with drug dealers. Teach them the joy of busting rocks. Clady was as good-hearted a man as ever ran for public office, but as a politician he was untrainable. He committed gaffe after gaffe, starting with a rape joke in front of reporters he had invited to visit his West Texas ranch. Speaking of the weather, he said it was like rape. There's nothing to do but sit back and enjoy it. Later, he refused to shake Anne's hand at a joint appearance. Having frittered away most of what had started as a 30-point lead in the polls, he volunteered that he had paid no income taxes in a year during which a lot of Texans had gone bust. By that time, it was apparent that Anne stood proudly for the future, and Clady stood just as proudly for the past. Republican women deserted him in droves, and Richards won by around 100,000 votes. When she claimed victory, she held up a T-shirt featuring the Capitol and the slogan, "A woman's place is in the dome." Every politician has her reasons for seeking office, and for Anne, I thought two were uppermost. One was to be a role model to show young girls what was possible. The other was to prove to the boys' club that dominated the Capitol that the girls could govern the state as well as the boys did. She could, but too many of those around her could not. Her mostly inexperienced staff caused her untold problems with the boys, particularly Lieutenant Governor Bullock. Never comfortable with strong women, he treated her with unpardonable rudeness. Still, she was popular with most legislators. Full of energy, she frequented the halls of the Capitol during her first legislative session. I know of at least two Republican House members who sent her roses. Texans liked having a star as governor, and she had an approval rating in the 60s for most of her time in office. She was a superb representative of Texas wherever she went. One of her foremost achievements was getting General Motors to keep open a plant in Arlington. She had the misfortune to take office soon after the Texas Supreme Court ruled that the state school finance system was unconstitutional, and the issue dogged her administration for 4 years. The voters rejected a proposed constitutional amendment to fix the inequities in the system, and eventually the legislature, still Democratic in those days, resorted to the plan that came to be known as Robin Hood. Her administration produced little else in the way of landmark legislation, an insurance reform bill, and a moratorium on the disposal of hazardous waste were her two major initiatives. She backed a bill establishing the lottery and opposed a proposal to allow Texans to carry handguns. It is conventional wisdom that the handgun issue led to her defeat because she vetoed a bill that would have authorized a statewide referendum on the subject. But I don't agree. The veto was a mistake, to be sure. Why not let the people vote and put off the issue itself for 2 more years until after the election? But that wasn't why she failed to win re-election. She lost for 3 reasons. 1, demographic change was remaking Texas into a suburban state, and suburbs are breeding grounds for Republicans. 2, the only Republican who could have beaten her, George W. Bush, decided to get in the race. And, most important, 3, Anne was worn down and dispirited by the shortcomings of her staff, particularly after the departure of her original chief of staff, Mary Beth Rogers, and her sharpest political advisor, Jane Hickey, and some of her appointees. The turning point for Richards, I believe, was the Lena Guerrero debacle in 1992. She had appointed Guerrero, an Austin legislator, to fill a vacancy on the Texas Railroad Commission. This was just the kind of appointment she ran for office to make. Guerrero was young, smart, hardworking, and politically talented, with a resume that touted her degree from the University of Texas and her membership in Phi Beta Kappa. Guerrero was running for election to her seat when Republicans found, by chance, that her resume was a lie. She had never graduated from UT, and she was not a member of Phi Beta Kappa. Guerrero's candidacy collapsed. I don't think Anne ever got over the betrayal. A few weeks later, Lloyd Benson resigned his Senate seat to become Secretary of the Treasury in the Clinton cabinet, and she had to find a replacement. The obvious choices were Cisneros, Hobby, State Comptroller Don Sharp, and Houston Congressman Mike Andrews. Hobby didn't want the job. Cisneros was known to be having an affair with his chief fundraiser. Sharp was pro-life and none too keen about going to Washington. Andrews was in Dutch with labor. I thought she should have appointed Sharp or Andrews anyway, but she settled on Bob Krueger, another railroad commissioner, who was a decade and a half past his prime, 1978, when he narrowly lost the Senate race to John Tower. Krueger served a few months and lost a special election to Kay Bailey Hutchison. I saw Anne in the Capitol during the 1993 legislative session, and she didn't look like the same person I had watched 2 years earlier. The ebullience of that first session was gone. Later, I had occasion to mention to her my observation of this change of attitude, and she said, poignantly, "If you mean, am I sadder but wiser, the answer is yes." I will never forget that moment. By then, the younger Bush had emerged as a possible opponent in 1994. The first poll, taken around November of 93, showed Richards with just a single-digit lead over someone who had nothing except a famous name. I sensed then that she was in trouble. But I think Anne knew it all the time. There was something fatalistic about her leap into the national spotlight coming at the expense of the father. "Poor George," she said of the Republican presidential nominee apparent at the 1988 Democratic National Convention. "He can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth," only to see him avenged by the sun. With Bush officially in the race, Texas Monthly decided to do profiles of the two candidates in the spring of 1994. My assignment was Richards. I went down to the Rio Grande Valley in February to see her appear in La Jolla, a small town that had been overwhelmed by immigration. The school district had had to build several new schools to accommodate the children of the newcomers, and the cost of paying off the bonds was a heavy burden on the largely working-class population. Richard spoke in a school cafetorium, and the place was overflowing. All the tables were full, all the wall space was occupied, and people were standing in open doorways. "I wish I could help you," she told the crowd, "but I just can't." I knew then that she would lose. It is rule one of politics that you always leave people with the hope that you can do something for them. "I'm going to go back to Austin and fight for you," she could have said, but she was too honest and, yes, too dispirited to lead them on. Her heart wasn't in the race. The headline for my story wrote itself, "Sadder but Wiser." Without her, we're sadder too, and less wise. Texas Monthly, The Renaissance of Anne, by Christopher Kelly. Issue, September 2012. Nearly 6 years after her death, Anne Richards, who is the subject of a new documentary, book, and stage play, still casts a long shadow. There are a number of moments in the new documentary, Anne Richards' Texas, that evoke the famous dictum, "The more things change in American politics, the more they stay the same." Early in the film, the directors, Keith Patterson and Jack Lofton, explore Richards' 1990 race for Texas governor against the wealthy businessman Clayton Williams, who suffered a major public relations setback in his campaign after questions arose over how little he paid in federal income tax. Patterson and Lofton also devote a considerable amount of screen time to Richards' bruising and ultimately failed 1994 re-election campaign against George W. Bush. In the film, Richards was the left-leaning populist, and Bush was running against her on behalf of highly organized big business interests. While no explicit references are made to the upcoming November elections, the directors certainly do not deny such interpretations. You can't help but look at some of the clips and some of the things that happened to Anne and draw direct parallels to President Obama, Patterson said during an interview earlier this month. He added, "There's this great American fight between the haves and the have-nots, and I don't think it will ever be over." Patterson and Lofton would seem to be unlikely biographers of Richards, who died of esophageal cancer in 2006 at 73. Patterson, 29, is from New York, where he majored in finance at Fordham University. Lofton, 31, spent a few years of his childhood in Dallas, but attended college and law school in Arkansas, where he is currently based. Patterson said they were attracted to her story, and particularly the significance of the 1994 Texas governor's race, which fueled the political careers of George W. Bush and his chief campaign strategist, Karl Rove. "That started setting off bells in my head of cause and effect," Patterson said. "If she had won her re-election, I think our world would be totally different." The directors began working on the project in 2010 and were embraced by Richards' wide network of friends and fans in Texas and beyond. Among the A-listers featured in the documentary are Bill Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Lily Tomlin, and Willie Nelson. Dolly Parton also appears and contributed music. The film, which is in negotiations for release on a television network, had its world premiere at the AFI Discovery Channel Silver Docs Documentary Festival in Silver Spring, Maryland, in June. It is next scheduled to be screened at the Dallas Video Festival in September and New York's Paley Center for the Media in October. In promoting Anne Richards' Texas, the filmmakers are trying to walk a thin line, Patterson said he does not want the film to be regarded merely as a rallying cry for liberals in a contentious election cycle. I don't know how we can be dismissed as liberal propaganda when we're talking about actual historical events, he said. But Curry Glassell, one of the film's producers, said she hopes the documentary has an influence on voters. Glassell is a Houston-based philanthropist and businesswoman who has so far this year donated more than $100,000 to Democrat fundraising organizations. She said she personally provided the majority of the financing for the documentary. This man is trying to create change and be a catalyst for something good, and everybody is against him, she said, comparing Obama to Richards. Ann Richards' Texas is not the only current Richards-related project in the works. In October, the University of Texas Press will publish Let the People In, The Life and Times of Ann Richards, a biography by Jan Reed, who was good friends with the former governor. And Ann, a one-woman play about Richards, written by and starring Holland Taylor, 2 1/2 Men, is moving to Broadway after successful runs in Texas, Chicago, and at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. According to Kevin Bailey, the show's executive producer, Ann will debut next spring, bypassing election season. We knew it could be construed as a partisan play, but that's not what we wanted, he said, of the decision on the timing for Broadway. Some observers say the reason Richards is suddenly looming so large in the culture, nearly 6 years after her death, and almost 2 decades since her political career ended, may actually have more to do with personality than partisanship. Her straight-from-the-hip, larger-than-life style has proven increasingly difficult for politicians to replicate in an era of micro-targeting, super-PACs, and endless mudslinging. Ann seems like this throwback to a time when there were giants who walked the earth, when politicians were honest with us and told us the truth and got things done as a matter of principle, said Wayne Slater, a political reporter for the Dallas Morning News and co-author of the book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. I think a lot of people wonder if we'll ever see a person like that again. Texas Monthly. Ann Richards' wonton ravioli with lemon cream sauce. Issue, July 1995. A half pound ground chicken, 2 green onions, minced. Half a teaspoon minced ginger root, 1 teaspoon minced garlic, 1 tablespoon sesame oil, 1 tablespoon soy sauce, 1 tablespoon cornstarch, 40 wonton wrappers, 1 tablespoon minced shallot, 2 tablespoon clarified butter, 3 tablespoon flour, 1 1/2 cups chicken stock, 1/2 cup heavy cream, 1 tablespoon lemon juice, salt and pepper to taste, 2 tablespoons cooking oil, 3 carrots cut in matchsticks, 3 stalks of celery cut in matchsticks, 3 zucchini cut in matchsticks, 2 cups green peas. To make ravioli, combine first 7 ingredients. Place 1 1/2 teaspoons of mixture in center of each wonton wrapper. Dip a finger in water and moisten sides of wonton. Fold into a triangle and seal outer edges. Moisten the 2 opposite corners and twist to seal. Allow wontons to dry for a few minutes on a sheet pan dusted with cornstarch. Cover with a slightly damp cloth. To make sauce, saute shallot in clarified butter over low heat for 1 minute. Blend in flour and cook slowly for about 2 minutes. Remove from heat and whisk in chicken stock. Return to heat and bring to a boil, whisking constantly, about 1 minute. Remove from heat. Add heavy cream, lemon juice, salt, and pepper. Keep warm until ready to serve. To cook ravioli, bring a pot of water to a simmer. Drop ravioli gently into water, adding no more than 12 or so at a time. Cook about 6 minutes. Remove gently with a slotted spoon. Keep warm. While ravioli are cooking, sauté vegetables in oil until crisp tender, adding peas last. To serve, place sautéed vegetables on each plate and arrange 5 or 6 ravioli on top. Ladle creams sauce over both. Serves 6.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 95 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 80s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Please note that in order to protect the safety of volunteers and staff and recording services around the country at this time, some productions have been reduced or eliminated. The show that follows substitutes for the program regularly scheduled for this time.
Again, you're swinging down the lane with David Miller. Today we salute listeners to station KBYI, broadcasting from the Brigham Young University campus in Rexburg, Idaho. From time to time, I try to catch up on my reading. And in these days, there's more than enough reason to stay home and do just that. So it is that I've been reviewing a copy of Downbeat magazine that dates back to October 1st, 1944. Though World War II was raging, the music industry was still very active, in many cases serving as a morale builder for members of the armed forces and their family and friends. On the cover of this issue of Downbeat, there's a glamour photo of a young woman identified as Harriet Clark. On an inside page, a brief article explained who she was. She was described as a model, a dancer, and a singer. In consulting my database, I found that she sang with bands led by both Sonny Dunham and Charlie Barnett. Digging deeper, I consulted Barnett's autobiography, to which he gave the title Those Swinging Years. Sure enough, on page 113, I read the following. I was in the famous door one night, feeling no pain, when I ran into Harriet Clark, who had sung with my band for a short time. She was a very pretty but somewhat naive young girl, and before you knew it, we were on a plane for Miami and my fourth marriage. Yes, that's right. That was Charlie Barnett's fourth marriage, and Harriet Clark gave him his only child, Charlie Barnett Jr. I guess it's only appropriate to add that she was the fourth of 11 women that Barnett married. Well, after that, we should listen to her singing with the band. From that brief time in 1940, when she was the featured female vocalist, she tells us what happened at a Dixie roadside diner.
Thank you. big electric sign at a Dixie roadside diner. Every night we'd part was more than just a lark, stealing kisses in the dark. And then with a slot machine playing, we would rumba to some pretty tune. Like a couple of kids, we were saying, hooray for June at a Dixie roadside diner. Where I went to dine, I lost this heart of mine in the heart of Caroline.
There was a rather sensational article on page one of Downbeat. The headline reads, TD's indictment cancels movie and air offers. TD, of course, is a reference to Tommy Dorsey. The article reports that he has been indicted on a criminal charge described as assault by means of force likely to produce great bodily harm. It seems that, at a party, Dorsey got into a fight with actor John Hall. His arrest meant that he would not, after all, appear in a movie that they had already filmed. They were going to cut Dorsey and the band out of the MGM movie Thrill of a Romance. As I looked into the situation further, I found that he was never tried because it couldn't be determined which of the two men started the fight. That meant that MGM didn't have to cut him out of the movie. From the soundtrack of that film, Thrill of a Romance, let's listen to a tune called The Guy with the Slide Trombone. It starts out with a teenaged actress, Helene Stanley, playing the piano and singing the lyrics. They borrow something from the classics, as Tommy Dorsey gives his version of a theme from the Hungarian Rhapsody.
Thank you. prince without a dime. The princess was his favorite chick. Quiznos, don't they? Couldn't click.